From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The CDC has new guidelines today for Americans who are fully vaccinated. They can now travel at low risk to themselves, but should still practice social distancing, mask wearing, and hand washing. It'll be welcomed advice to the more than 56 million fully vaccinated Americans, but it also comes as infections in 32 states are rising. Here's Anthony Fauci on NPR this morning.
Some of the states and cities have pulled back a bit on the mitigation methods, namely pulling back on mask mandates and pulling back on the guidelines of crowded places and physical distancing. That, together with the fact that we're having a dominant variant, is leading to those increases.
Let's bring in Dr. Jean Marazzo. She's director of the University of Alabama's Division of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Marazzo, welcome back.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me, Peter.
Yeah, and let's start with those new guidelines. Vaccinated Americans can fly, but they still got to be careful. Why is that?
Well, I think that the question of how safe is really the issue with being vaccinated. We've had some great news this week about vaccine efficacy, and I'll just tell you very quickly that the durability of the immune response, it looks like it's going to be really good. Pfizer reported that at 6 months, people are still protected in a robust fashion. The safety is looking good as time goes on, and critically, coverage of some of the emerging variants looks good, which is really the race that we're running right now against the virus. So when you put all that together, you could say, you know, why even worry? Why not just get on a plane, pile in, get close, and have parties with your family? The real issue is that you're still part of a population in whom the vaccine coverage is unclear, right? We really have to stop thinking about individual immunity and think again about population level immunity. So I think the CDC's message is, you know, it's just not time to let up because we have not reached the point where you should feel totally safe. 1 in 6 people, right, are vaccinated in this country. And we've got to just do better before we can really let our guard down.
Well, and we can see the disease is still spreading, though new infections are now driven by people who are 45 years old and younger. Look at nursing home cases. They're down 83%, for example.
Exactly.
And many people, I wonder, doctor, if you think are thinking that, well, you know, we've got a good number of older people who are vaccinated now. We can take risks now because I'm younger and it's just not much of a danger to me.
Absolutely. So we've had this sort of double message or two-sided message all along, and that is that young people, quote unquote, and you can define that however you want, don't do as badly with this infection. And in general, that's true. Clearly, with mortality, it's distinctly age-related. The problem is that, and we appropriately have been focusing on protecting those vulnerable people by targeting them for vaccination, and that's fantastic. The challenge is protecting those vulnerable people by targeting them for vaccination, and that's fantastic. The challenge is that that has necessarily deprioritized the group that is we knew was going to be more interactive, more out and about, more willing to take risks for all those reasons. And so you have that combined with, I think, a sense of increasing safety plus loosening of restrictions plus the big wild card, increased infectious variants, right? So all of that, I think, is combining to inform these surges that we're seeing. And while it's great that we have a bunch of people who are protected, that may not be enough to prevent this tide getting into younger people who then can go on to continue to infect other people.
Well, and the temptation is certainly there. It's Easter weekend. It's the last weekend of Passover. People are exhausted, rightly so, but that doesn't mean we can let our guard down because, as doctors have said, it's not me, we're almost there. We just got to get to the finish line. Dr. Jean Marazzo, she's a director of the University of Alabama's Division of Infectious Diseases. Thanks, as always. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
I heard George Floyd saying, I can't breathe, please. Get off of me. I can't breathe. He cried for his mom. He was in pain.
That's Darnella Frazier, a witness who testified in the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis on Tuesday. She was just 17 when she recorded the video viewed round the world of George Floyd being pinned to the ground by Chauvin during an arrest last May. The former police officer faces murder and manslaughter charges for kneeling on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. It's been an emotional first week of testimony, playing out during Holy Week and ending on Good Friday, when Christians mark the crucifixion of Jesus. Prosecutors agreed before the trial that expert witnesses would not be allowed to compare Floyd's death to Christ's because, in the words of the court, such analogy is prejudicial. Yet for some, it's impossible not to see some parallels. Joining us now is Seth Martin. He's the lead pastor at the Brook Community Church in South Minneapolis. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Pastor Martin, we'll get to the parallels in a moment, but I want to start by just asking how you're doing this week. It's been a difficult trial to watch.
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I have probably cried more this week about it than I have in, you know, at least the last few months. And my wife has been more emotional about George Floyd's murder as well as just the trial than I think we maybe initially even anticipated. And I have thought a lot about this trial and it taking place in beginning, I should say, during Holy Week. And so it's been a week of a lot of reflection and a lot of emotions and a lot of thinking.
Well, so how are you thinking about the backdrop of Holy Week and ending on Good Friday? I mean, what are some of the parallels that you see between the death of George Floyd and the crucifixion of Jesus?
There are so many shadows of the cross in George Floyd's story. And I think the one that comes to mind immediately is Jesus also was killed by Roman government officials. Derek Chauvin, you know, represented the police department of Minneapolis. He was meant to be a servant of the city and of law, if you will, and he took George Floyd's life. I think one of the other parallels that is interesting is realizing that whereas Jesus died in a unjust way, so did George Floyd. And whereas as a faith leader and as a Christian, I believe Jesus did it for us and for the sins of the world. Jesus laid down his life. George Floyd's life was taken away from him. You know, even amongst the witnesses, it's a very interesting, as I listened to the testimonies this past week, and I can't help but think about the witnesses that were around the scene of Jesus's crucifixion. And then I think, you know, finally, and one of the most striking ones to me is thinking about the people who helped Jesus bear his cross. You know, I can't help but think about the dispatcher and the firefighter and those people who tried to help George to bear the weight, who tried to see George be alleviated from that weight and yet ultimately could not do so. And so the similarities between the crucifixion and George Floyd's death and now this trial, they're quite striking.
You know, I want to acknowledge something you said a little bit earlier, Pastor Martin, which is that there are some significant differences between the central characters here. And so I'm mindful that for Christians who believe Jesus was the Son of God, any comparison to him can quickly break down. But it sounds like you're not so much saying George Floyd is akin to Jesus Christ as saying the circumstances of their deaths share some important qualities that are worth talking about. And so I'm wondering how you're talking about those things with your congregation this week. And I also wonder whether you imagine those conversations are playing out differently in predominantly black churches versus predominantly white churches.
Amongst our congregation, we are being careful, of course, not to make George Floyd Jesus. It's important to see that while we are hoping for justice and hoping for a conviction, we still ultimately depend on God to vindicate George Floyd. We still ultimately depend upon God to hold Derek Chauvin accountable and those who also were responsible. One of the things I think I'm thinking about a lot, too, the past couple of days, as I watch Derek Chauvin, there's a hope in me for him that says that I hope he's like that soldier at the end of that crucifixion narrative, who after he realized what he had done, said, surely this must have been the Son of God. I believe a conviction should take place. That's my opinion. But more than that, I really do hope that he and those others who are responsible would experience repentance and that they would see after that, after what they had done, they would say, surely, not that George Floyd was the Son of God, but I pray that they would see him and say, surely this was a child of God. And we took his life. Perhaps some of the conversations are different in predominantly black congregations versus maybe predominantly white congregations. And I think some of the challenge is between seeing this through the lens of this was a person who broke the law, you know, allegedly, and therefore got what he deserved, and that was just an officer doing their job. I think you have some people who have that lens, and I think you have other people who look at it through the lens and say, no, this was a person, and no matter what you think about George, that is a child of God, and he was worthy of human dignity and being treated as such.
Seth Martin is the lead pastor of the Brook Community Church in South Minneapolis. Pastor Martin, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
It's impossible to talk about the current state of gun control in America without mentioning the National Rifle Association, the NRA. Formed as a marksmanship group after the Civil War, it became one of the most powerful lobbying organizations in the U.S. by the 1990s, wielding both immense coffers and a voting constituency that put gun ownership rights at the heart of their political involvement. The NRA reshaped gun control policy and loosened regulations around gun ownership in the U.S. by pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into campaigns and lobbying efforts. But in January, the group declared bankruptcy. And as President Biden mulls executive action on gun control and a universal background check bill is debated in the Senate, where is the NRA's influence felt today? Matthew Lacombe is an assistant professor of political science at Barnard College, and he's been writing about the NRA's political influence. Matthew, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you. And I'm hoping that you can start by just sort of explaining what the NRA's influence has looked like, especially since the 1990s. What would you describe as sort of the main pillars of their political power over the gun control conversation in the U.S.?
Sure. So what I argue is that the NRA's political power is in large part wrapped up with its ability to mobilize its mass level supporters, NRA members, gun owners, gun rights supporters, by sort of creating a situation in which gun ownership is an important lens through which a lot of NRA supporters view and act upon politics. The NRA has then been very successful at mobilizing them into political action by portraying that identity as under threat. Moreover, in recent decades, the NRA has closely aligned itself with the Republican Party. In more recent years, following prominent mass shootings, we really often haven't even seen serious legislative proposals enter the agenda. And I think that's in part because most of those shootings have occurred when at least part of our national leadership, whether in Congress or the White House, were led by NRA-aligned Republicans who are dedicated to the group's cause in part because of the electoral support the organization provides, and of course also in part because the NRA money has helped them with their campaigns and building a sort of infrastructure to help them gain votes, something that the NRA did successfully when Donald Trump, for example, won in 2016.
Have we entered a new phase then, though, Matthew? Because the NRA of today is not the NRA of 10 or 20 years ago. I mean, they filed for bankruptcy a few months ago, as we mentioned. So, I mean, what kind of shape is the organization in? Would it be fair to say that its influence is on the wane?
So on the one hand, it's true. The NRA organizationally is in a very bad spot. It's hurting financially. It's undergone quite a bit of infighting and turnover. And it's still facing lawsuits that are existential threats to its long-term existence. Moreover, we're in a situation in which the NRA's opponents, gun safety advocacy organizations, are stronger than they've been in quite a long time. So the NRA both has sort of stronger foes than in the past and is much weaker organizationally. Having said that, that sort of base of politically dedicated gun rights supporters that the NRA really helped build over the course of many decades isn't necessarily going anywhere. So even if the NRA ceases to exist tomorrow, the base of support that they built behind gun rights will remain. And where that will go if the NRA itself wanes or ceases to exist is difficult to say. It could be that the community becomes fragmented. It could be that more extreme groups than the NRA pop up in order to now guide those supporters and mobilize them into action on behalf of various causes. We're entering a sort of new era of the gun debate.
Well, then it makes me wonder, and I guess this is a two-part question, what the window here looks like from your view. Democrats control both houses of Congress. They've got the White House. And with the NRA hobbled, as you just described, do they have an opportunity to finally pass some meaningful gun control measures in Congress. But then I guess the follow-up that goes with that, even if they do, what might they have to contend with in the courts, mindful that we have a conservative-leaning Supreme Court that could strike down some gun control measures, as we saw in the Heller case several years ago?
Sure. So in the short term, I'm skeptical that legislatively passed gun control laws will be enacted. The Republicans, of course, can still filibuster legislation that the Democrats pursue, and I think that they would do so on the gun control issue. Moreover, I'm not sure that the Democrats really want to prioritize that and go all in on it right now. We're still the first 100 days of Joe Biden's presidency, and I think he's really focused on other matters. And that's something that gun safety advocacy groups are trying to push him and other leading Democrats on, although I would expect the White House to use some unilateral action to tighten regulations on guns. And then your point about the judiciary is a good one. So control of the White House and control of Congress has changed hands, and the Democrats now have it. But the judges that have been, the pro-gun judges that have been appointed by prior Republican presidents, including President Trump, are still in office. And there are signals that the scope of the Second Amendment and the way in which it's interpreted will become increasingly pro-gun, even if the federal government and Congress and in the White House decides to pursue new legislation in the short or midterm.
So then what's the bottom line for the NRA, Matthew? I mean, this is a group that you've studied so closely. What does the future for the NRA look like? And does it even matter? Maybe its legacy lives on through the voting bloc it created, no matter what happens to the group itself.
Of course, part of it depends on what happens with the lawsuit that's been launched by the New York Attorney General seeking to dissolve the organization. If that is successful, then it might spell the end for the NRA. However, even if the NRA avoids that outcome, and I think it's likely that the NRA will avoid total dissolution, there are still big questions about what its future might look like. And part of those questions are actually related to its really close relationship with Donald Trump. The NRA, although being aligned with the Republicans for a few decades now, was unusually close with Trump. And so now it's in this situation in which it may find itself somewhat inextricably linked to a set of ideas and an approach to politics that's increasingly viewed as toxic by a lot of potential NRA members who own guns but don't share its sort of broader outlook on politics, by Democrats, you know, who obviously are not on board with Trumpism, and even by many in the GOP, including some of its leaders, who'd like to see their own party go in a different direction. If that happens, we could envision a scenario in which both political parties and a lot of sort of mass-level gun owners turn away from the NRA, and that would be a scenario in which gun politics would fundamentally change in ways that I think would make the passage of new gun regulations, at least in the mid and long term, if not the short term, much more likely.
Matthew Lacombe is an assistant professor of political science at Barnard College who studies the National Rifle Association. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
A small domestic miracle happened this week in my family that I'd like you to know about. On Wednesday morning, after doing an interview for this show, I went downstairs to help my daughters get off to school. I found little Marissa, 5 years old, sitting alone outside in the driveway. "Look, Daddy," she said. "I did it." Marissa had tied her shoe for the first time. Later that day, when she got home from school, she did it again. And this time, I was recording.
So you have to make a big X, and then you do a big loop, and another big loop, and then another one.
Oh, the anticipation.
Yay.
You did it. Oh, that's so cool. You did it. How do you feel?
Good. Proud.
I've been thinking about why something so small felt so big. When Marissa took her first steps, I wasn't there to catch her. When she said her first words, I didn't hear them. My wife and I adopted Marissa and her older sister, Mackenzie, last spring while the virus was just starting to tear families apart. We unceremoniously signed the paperwork on the hood of a social worker's car because the courts had gone dark. In this year, we have gained and lost so much. On New Year's Eve, my godfather, my baseball-loving Uncle Pat, was lost to COVID. He died alone in the hospital with a nurse holding his hand. And if that has happened to your family too, I'm sorry. The stress coursing through my body has reached levels I've never felt before. I'm short with the kids. I'm impatient, and for what, I don't know. And then I'm hit with something like this, a beautiful brown-eyed little girl who just learned to tie her shoe.
This side is harder for me.
The left side is harder than the right side, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you know what? You got one of them.
It
what does it feel like to tie your shoes? Do you feel like a big girl?
Yeah.
I think you are. You're getting bigger.
Can I do this again?
Yeah, go ahead. Isn't it something to know that if our fortune holds, the kids will grow. And though we're bruised, we will carry on.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about TV, movies, and more, like the new Marvel Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and a definitive ranking of the best Muppets. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Politicians and pundits have been voicing concern about the 18,000 migrant children and teens in overwhelmed federal facilities along the border with Mexico, and President Biden has been criticized for his handling of the situation. But the Trump administration policies also played a role. Elizabeth Troval from Houston Public Media spoke with lawyers who work directly with these migrant kids to learn about the road ahead.
Democrats and Republicans alike have called conditions at overcrowded Border Patrol facilities holding migrant youth unacceptable. Many are trying to play the blame game.
Many Democrats like to pretend their open border policies are somehow humane. There is nothing humane about what Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are doing at the border.
That's Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz on Fox News. The network showed footage of kids wrapped in Mylar blankets that looked like tinfoil.
They're endangering their lives in a pandemic by keeping them locked up in cages right on top of each other.
And you know, I know it doesn't look good to have them under those, whatever those blankets are called, but to send them back into Mexico is not the answer.
That's attorney Dick Horstman. He says while conditions on the border are bad, the alternative, sending kids back into life-threatening circumstances, is worse. That's what the Trump administration did. Citing coronavirus concerns, the government turned away kids and teens at the border. They were sent back into Mexico or their home countries, where many say they were fleeing danger or even death. Horstman says what Biden's doing by letting in minors traveling alone is far from open borders, especially since some families and adults are still being turned away.
You know, he is doing what the law requires. You know, what he has decided is that, at least for the kids, I'm not going to use COVID as an excuse for keeping them out of the United States. I'm not going to send them back to Mexico and let them fend for themselves.
Horstman says not letting kids in before is one reason why so many minors are showing up now. That, plus seasonal increases and limited capacity, have overwhelmed border officials and the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement, known as ORR. Dalia Castillo-Granados runs the Children's Immigration Law Academy.
You know, I wouldn't say that the process is perfect, but the intention behind the ORR process is to release children as quickly as possible.
She says the public doesn't understand. There's a long-standing process in place to get migrant children quickly connected to family members. She says concerns about quality of care and shelters are valid, but ultimately, the housing is temporary.
You know, being detained is not ideal for any child, but it is typically a very short period of their life here in the U.S.
She says the process a child must go through to legally live in the U.S. is complicated. That's why, in her view, what these kids need most is legal support. Even with an attorney, these cases are hard to win. Attorney Brandon Roche says that's in part because of Trump-era policies.
And honestly, the biggest issue is the broken asylum system or broken immigration law system and how long it's going to take them to go through any process and the odds being stacked against them because of the bad immigration laws and policies.
The legal journey can take years, and at the end of it, many kids will likely end up either deported or undocumented. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Kiara Alegria Hudes is a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who's also known for her collaboration with Lin-Manuel Miranda on the Tony-winning musical In the Heights. And now she's written a deeply personal memoir about growing up in Philadelphia with her vibrant Puerto Rican mother and her abuela, her grandmother, on whose steps she heard the stories that would inspire her art. The memoir is called My Broken Language, and Kiara Alegria Hudes joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
It's a delight to have you, and I want to start by asking you about the title of your memoir, which is kind of surprising for a playwright who actually has such great command of language. You write language, you write dialogue for a living. So why did you call your memoir My Broken Language?
Well, there's a passage later in the book where I talk about getting to Brown University and I want to be a playwright. And my mentor is Paula Vogel, and she's won Pulitzers, and she's this amazing creature full of creativity and luminosity. And she says to me, she looks me right in the eye and she says, if your Spanish is broken, because she knows my background, she knows I come from a mixed Puerto Rican family. She says, your Spanish is broken, then write your broken Spanish. And it's amazing what a little permission does to just open up someone's heart. So that was the permission I needed to take my broken languages and build something new. And you know, English, which is my first language and I'm most comfortable in, it's not the right language to describe all of me. So I'm stuck and it's a problem. And I'm looking for other languages to describe all of who I am.
So this sort of mishmash of languages in your childhood comes partly out of having a white father and a Latina mother. Her family is from Puerto Rico. And early in your life, you write about how it was very common in your West Philadelphia neighborhood to have friends who were also mixed race children. But then later when your parents split, it seems as though you're sort of pulled increasingly between two separate worlds. How did that experience shape you, do you think?
All of a sudden, the two different cultural elements of my life were 60 miles apart from each other and had nothing to do with each other. And that's when the division in my life began. And I started to experience my two cultures as separate family experiences, as separate social experiences. And that separation was sobering and oftentimes very upsetting to me.
You write very eloquently and actually very painfully about the day that your father remarried. He married a white woman, and being left out of a family picture that day seemed like an impactful experience in your life. Did that contribute to feeling like an outsider beyond just that day?
During my dad's remarriage, I get upset and I run away and I run into the woods and I make a pact with the woods that I'm going to keep quiet and swallow my upsetness and try to find safe spaces where nothing can hurt me. Those spaces where nothing could hurt me would be like Abuela's staircase, and I'd be sitting on the staircase kind of watching in awe at a safe distance as my cousins threw down dancing merengue and bachata on the 4th of July. Like, I would always find a kind of safe remove and kind of numb myself. But at the same time, those safe spaces often let me kind of be an eavesdropper, an observer of life, which came in handy when I decided to become a writer because I had really paid a lot of attention.
You know, that phrase you mentioned a moment ago really stands out to me, that you made a pact with the woods, the sort of personification of nature. That comes from your mother, doesn't it? The way that she practiced religion and spirituality. You write about that.
She was a spiritual genius. I don't know another way to describe it. She understood the way spirits worked. For instance, she was an herbalist, and so she taught me how to, I was kind of her assistant in making her herb garden. Later in my life, after my parents separated and I was a pre-adolescent, she goes even deeper into her spiritual gifts and becomes a priestess of Jango in the Lukumi Afro-Caribbean tradition.
What's interesting to me, Kiara, is the way that even as your mother is so in tune with her spiritual life, she's also firmly rooted in earthly matters in the sense that she's an activist. In fact, she helps start a center in your Philadelphia neighborhood to help lower infant mortality, among other causes.
Her concern was what we said Hispanic at that time, Hispanic women's health. And so she would take immigrant Latinas to the gynecologist for the first time. She would help women who were undocumented deliver babies safely in hospitals without fear of deportation. And so while my mother was kind of this amazing, looming spiritual genius to me, she was also a really like in the community making stuff happen, trying to help people leader. And so to me, naturally, those things went hand in hand.
You and your mother, you seem to share so many qualities, but you also write about one key difference between the two of you, which was your complexion. There's this powerful scene in your childhood where the feminist Gloria Steinem mm-hmm. comes to visit the center where your mother works, and you take note that your own lighter skin more closely resembles your mother's white bosses than your mother's skin. And Gloria Steinem is meeting literally behind a glass wall with only white staffers there. The women of color who work in the center are left out of this meeting. And you wonder which side of the glass you would belong on.
There were so many instances like that in my life. And I think oftentimes mixed race and mixed ethnicity people are told to choose one side to identify with. And those were moments when I felt like, well, what would I choose in that moment? And I think at a certain point in my writing life, I felt there was so much invisibility in the Perez side of my family. There was so much untold history. I did make a choice. I made a really conscious choice. And I said, I'm writing this. This is the best book I have never read. And so that was the choice I made as a storyteller.
You know, I have to ask about one other really painful chapter in your memoir that just so stands out. It's an episode where your mother discovers a scar that she previously had not noticed on her own mother, your grandmother. And the history of this is that your grandmother had lived in Arecibo in Puerto Rico, and unbeknownst to her at the time, she and others who accepted vouchers for what they thought was going to be birth control were actually sterilized, and that this was a widespread practice. I bring it up because it reminds me of the conversation that we're having today in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a vaccine rollout, looking at the history of medical abuses, including the Tuskegee experiments on Black Americans. And it made me wonder what that legacy is in the Latinx community, whether you see any distrust of the medical profession that's rooted in things like that sterilization program.
It's anecdotal because it's the women in my family and women who are friends. But I think the vibe was just like, okay, you know what? Like, we'll take the vaccine, but we don't want to go first. We don't want to be the test round. So after they had seen that the vaccines were going okay and were being administered well, it was like, okay, now we can go. Now we feel a little safer.
Understandably, that concern about being used as guinea pigs.
Yeah.
So now you've released this memoir as we are still in the midst of a pandemic, and it's looking back, but I will note, unless you decide that you're hanging it up early, Kiara, that you probably have quite a bit of career left, even though you're taking a pause right now to write a memoir and look back. I wonder what we should expect to come next from you and how you're looking at the future of stage plays, because we're coming off of a year plus now where you haven't had what I imagine is the highlight of your experiences, seeing your work staged in front of a live audience.
I felt really at home writing this memoir, and I would like to keep writing prose, if it's memoirs or essays. It was a really nice change for me. I have been playwriting for 15 years, writing off-Broadway, on-Broadway. And I love the plays because it's collaborative and you're working with bodies in space. And that's a sacred practice. I love it so much. But there is a quiet in writing a book that let me be so introspective. So I'm not ready to pivot back to stage quite yet, but I am working on some stage projects, also doing the film adaptation of my Broadway musical In the Heights. So that's what's next.
Chiara Alegria Hudi's new memoir is called My Broken Language. Chiara, thank you.
Thank you.
President Biden's infrastructure plan includes $20 billion to reconnect urban neighborhoods fractured by interstate highways built decades ago with little thought given to the people who lived along their routes. The White House singles out a few prime examples of that inequity, including the Claiborne Expressway in New Orleans. For years, residents have called for its removal, and Amy Stelly is one of them. She's co-founder of a group called the Claiborne Avenue Alliance, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And tell me about this highway and how it fits or doesn't fit into your neighborhood.
Well, the highway, otherwise known as the bridge in New Orleans, that's our favorite name for it, doesn't fit into the community. And it was actually rammed through Treme and parts of the 7th Ward back in the late 60s. And what it did was completely severed the community and just eradicated affordable housing in the 7th Ward neighborhood. So it really did a lot of damage to two communities that are famous in New Orleans. Hmm.
What's it look like and what's it like to live so close to it?
Well, it's ugly and it's dirty and it's an environmental hazard. When we have torrential rains here, the water comes off of the highway in sheets, and that water is very hot and dirty. And the interstate has not been maintained in all of its life. So the waterproofing is gone, and the dirty water comes through the deck. So you can get rained on as you walk under the bridge, as we love to call it. So it's a real menace. Not only that, it causes vibration, the air pollution. My home vibrates from the heavy truck traffic on the interstate.
What was the neighborhood like before that highway was put in? I understand that Claiborne Avenue used to be a vibrant street. It was lined with oak trees that were cut down to put the road in.
Yes, it was beautiful. There are people who are older than me who have very fond memories of the vibrancy of the neighborhood. It was the commercial center for Black New Orleans at a time when Black people could not shop on Canal Street because New Orleans, like the rest of the South, was segregated. So Claiborne was the place to go. We celebrated Mardi Gras. And one of the most painful things is that the beautiful stands of oak trees were bulldozed on Ash Wednesday, the day after Mardi Gras. So it was a real stab to the heart of the Black community, painful memory.
You've been talking about this for years, and then all of a sudden, President Biden's infrastructure plan comes out, and it specifically singles out this stretch of highway in your neighborhood as an example of unjust infrastructure. What did you think when you heard that? Were you surprised?
I was floored. I have to tell you, I was floored and overjoyed to hear, number one, that my work has been recognized because I have been very vocal about the removal of the highway. But more importantly, very happy that the Biden administration is now sensitive to the inequity that this has caused in many, many Black communities around the nation.
Well, the White House hasn't said how the money in the plan could be used. We don't even know if it's going to get through Congress, and it's going to be expensive no matter what. So what is your vision for it? What would you do with this thing?
I would totally remove it. There has been discussion of removing ramps and That simply won't work. In order for Treme and the Seventh Ward to be made whole again, the elevated highway has to be removed because we can't have that many cars and that much pollution. We can fix our transportation issues by just using the boulevards and putting in good, efficient transit.
But a lot of people use that stretch of I-10. Would you propose getting rid of it altogether or put it underground or what? Because wouldn't it create other problems if you just bulldozed it?
Well, we can't put a highway underground here because
right,
the land
yeah.
is too Water soft. Table. We are swamp. And actually, that was tried for the riverfront. And not long ago, the initial part of the tunnel that was built collapsed. This would have to be totally removed, the boulevard rebuilt. And we have had a traffic study that shows that the traffic can be effectively dispersed.
If you zoom out from your neighborhood, you could see cases like this in cities all over where highways were put into the poorest neighborhoods and they've had to suffer from the consequences ever since. What does your neighborhood, Treme, have to teach us about that?
Well, Treme is a poster child to show you what disinvestment looks like. The highway destroyed a lot. The businesses moved out. We have a lot of vacant lots, a lot of abandoned structures. The reinvestment in the neighborhood is slow, but we need to make sure as things speed up again that it's done through a lens of equity.
Amy Stelly of the Claiborne Avenue Alliance talking about her years-long effort to get a stretch of I-10 demolished. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.
We'll be right back.